From Ground Zero Radio, this is Democracy Now in Exile.
On September 11th, George Bush, Sr. and Jr. enabled the regime that killed my father, and now I want to organize so that never happens again.
Another world is possible. Conversations in a time of terror. Today, we'll speak with editors of the first progressive anthology and film created in response to September 11th. Then, after an attempted coup in Haiti, armed commandos set fire to the headquarters of the opposition Convergent, shouting, "We will never support another coup d'etat." The coup left 7 dead and scores wounded. All that and more coming up. Welcome to the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Afghan troops said they are preparing to attack a mountain hideout where the Taliban leader Mullah Muhammad Omar is said to have fled with 500 men. 10 days after the fall of the Taliban stronghold of Kandahar, the city's intelligence chief says that Mullah Omar has been traced to a mountain hideout northwest of the city. He said ethnic Pashtun forces are hunting him, and when they find him, they will hang him. U.S. forces are continuing to hunt for Osama bin Laden and al-Qaeda forces, but after killing thousands of Afghan civilians and forcing hundreds of thousands to flee their homes, Defense Department officials admit it's anybody's guess where either bin Laden or Mohammed Omar have gone. 2 U.S. warplanes came under fire from surface-to-air missiles in Afghanistan today. Neither plane was hit. A Marine spokesperson said the missiles may have been shoulder-fired Stingers built for the U.S. infantry and secretly supplied to Afghan Mujahideen fighting the Soviet occupation in the 1980s. The London Independent is reporting there are strong indications the United States is preparing contingency plans to launch air attacks on Somalia from bases in neighboring Kenya, despite a lack of convincing evidence that al-Qaeda groups of any significance are operating in Somalia. The prospect of an attack is causing considerable unease in Kenya and enormous fear in Somalia. The fears were sparked by meetings earlier this month between Kenya's president, Daniel Arap Moi, and high-ranking U.S. State Department officials, at which the president offered his support for the U.S. as it looks to expand the so-called war on terrorism. Last week, newspapers reported that U.S. officials and special forces personnel had met with Somali officials and scouted out possible targets for a U.S. attack. The White House said yesterday the anthrax used in letter attacks appears to have been produced in the United States, but that the identity of those who mailed them remains a mystery. White House Press Secretary Ari Fleischer said yesterday the evidence on the anthrax sent to Senators Tom Daschle and Patrick Leahy is increasingly looking like it was a domestic source. Barbara Hatch Rosenberg of the Federation of American Scientists said yesterday there are perhaps 50 people in the United States with the knowledge to stage such deadly anthrax attacks. India put its army on high alert along the border with Pakistan and the disputed state of Kashmir yesterday after Pakistani troop movements were reported. The move came as India's cabinet called an emergency session to decide its response to the attacks on the Indian parliament last Thursday by Muslim Kashmiri militants alleged to be linked to Pakistani intelligence. Nuclear-armed India said it would be within its rights to send troops across the border to hunt militants in Pakistani-controlled Kashmir. Nuclear-armed Pakistan dismissed the allegation of involvement in the parliament attack as fabricated and promised a tough response to any military strike. 33 armed men stormed the presidential palace in Haiti just before dawn yesterday in an apparent coup attempt. At least 7 people were killed before police retook the palace. Israel's security forces killed 3 people yesterday, including a Hamas activist and a 12-year-old child, prompting Hamas leaders to announce they would disregard Palestinian Yasser Arafat's call for an end to the attack on Israelis. In related news, Israeli police yesterday detained a prominent Palestinian official and peace advocate while he was holding a Muslim holiday reception in Jerusalem, calling it a terrorist activity. Sari Nusseibeh, the Palestinian Liberation Organization's most senior official in Israeli-occupied East Jerusalem, was arrested as he hosted a party for European diplomats for the end of Ramadan. Israel's far-right public security minister justified the detention by stating Palestinian officials holding a meeting in East Jerusalem undermined Israel's sovereignty in the city and therefore constituted a terrorist act. Australian officials said today that asylum seekers protested then rioted in one of Australia's controversial outback detention centers, setting fire to up to 15 buildings and causing staff to flee. The Attorney General said the protest began as a peaceful demonstration by women and children against conditions in the prison camps, one of six in Australia, where undocumented migrants are detained while their cases are assessed, a process which can take years. Australia has come under international criticism for its policy of mandatory detention of undocumented immigrants, but Prime Minister John Howard has refused to budge, having won re-election just days ago on an anti-immigrant platform. Senior Bush administration officials said yesterday they're exploring ways to give Otto Reich and Eugene Scalia temporary appointments during the upcoming congressional recess if the Senate doesn't act on them this week. Otto Reich is a former Reagan administration official who ran an illegal covert domestic propaganda effort against Nicaragua's Sandinista government during the 80s. He's the president's choice to be Secretary of Western Hemisphere Affairs. Eugene Scalia is the son of the conservative Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia and a chief supporter of overturning the ergonomic standard proposed by the Clinton administration and supported by every major labor union in the United States. He's now Bush's choice to be the Labor Department's top lawyer. The state of Nevada filed suit today in its continuing effort to prevent the federal government from establishing a nuclear waste burial site at Yucca Mountain, about 90 miles from Las Vegas. The suit argues that under a new rule, the Energy Department plans to disregard the site's geology and make its decision based on alleged safety of the metal canisters that would hold the waste. The proposed nuclear waste site in Nevada sits on an active volcano and earthquake fault. Federal law requires the choice be based on its geology, and the suit argues that the Energy Department could use its new rules to justify storing nuclear waste anywhere in the country.
Beware the false motives of others. Be careful of those who pretend to be brothers, and you never suppose it's those who are closest to you.
Forgive them, Father. You're listening to the War and Peace Report. That was Lauryn Hill from The Miseducation of Lauryn Hill. I'm Amy Goodman. In the early hours of Monday morning, as most of the nation slept, a pack of armed commandos stormed Haiti's National Palace in a coup attempt that left seven dead, scores wounded. The violence lasted until mid-morning yesterday as police faced off attackers inside the palace and thousands of government supporters gathered outside, shouting, "We'll never support another coup d'etat." They then set fire to the headquarters of the opposition Convergence Alliance, as well as to the home of the alliance's leader. By afternoon, relative calm had been restored to the island, and President Jean-Bertrand Aristide was able to address the nation with what he called his message of hope. Neither he nor his wife was in the palace at the time of the attack. Both remained unharmed, along with other members of government. While no group has claimed responsibility for the attack, it's widely believed it was orchestrated by the former police chief of northern Capacian City, Guy Philippe. Philippe fled the country for the neighboring Dominican Republic last year, along with seven police officers, when they were accused of plotting a coup against then-president René Préval. The attempted coup came exactly 11 years and one day after President Aristide was first voted into office on a platform of participation, transparency, and justice. He stayed in power over 8 months before a bloody military coup forced him from Haiti in 1991. After 3 years in exile, he was finally returned to the country with the support of U.S. troops and the promise of aid and assistance from the international community. He remained in office 16 months before term limits forced him to step down in 96. He was replaced by his protege, René Préval, who governed the country until elections once again placed Aristide in power last year. We're joined in the Firehouse studio by Kim Ives, who is the editor of Haiti Progrès, the newspaper. And we're going to go down to Haiti as well and speak with Jean-Gérard Debris, who is Secretary of State for Public Defense in Haiti. Jean-Gérard Debris, can you begin just by describing the scene yesterday morning? What exactly took place?
Yesterday morning, the group, commando got into the palace, and they were well armed, and facing.
I'm having a little trouble. I'm having a little trouble understanding you. If you could speak louder.
Okay. Yesterday morning, they had a commando got into the palace, there for a coup d'etat, and they were like a bunch of guys, well armed, and they found a resistance to the palace. And after, you know, some, you know, firing and that, and they got away, and one got killed, and we had on outside people killed and one.
We're having a little problem with the phone. How many people died?
Outside?
Yes.
Two people died. Two mm-hmm. police.
And then we understand that in response, supporters of Aristide burned down the headquarters of the opposition Convergence.
Well, while it was this happening, they had some problems to get everything in order about the police department and the administration and all that. And some people and then the population, you know, some things happen, you know. Unfortunately, something happened because while we were trying to reorganize the administration and the police.
And do you know exactly who's behind the coup attempt?
Oh, we don't know yet. You know, it's a little bit early now to say who's behind it.
Kim Ives, you have been covering Haiti, in Haiti and from here for many years. Can you set the backdrop for us, and was this in any way expected?
Well, yeah, I think it was very much expected. What we're seeing in Haiti today is really the template of what we saw in Nicaragua two decades ago. Essentially, the U.S. is unhappy with Aristide because his original program, at least, was democratic nationalist. That is, he felt that the state industries of Haiti, which the U.S. and international lending institutions have been pressuring Haiti to privatize, they're presently nationalized. And on that program, he was elected in 1990. The U.S. was very unhappy with that and has sought to overturn him since then. We know we had a coup in 1991 for 3 years, and Aristide managed to come back in 1994 and be reelected in 2000. But what the U.S. did was essentially undermine that election cast it into doubt using the OAS. And since that time, the Organization of American States. And since that time, they've been waging a low-intensity war with the same types of characters that they used in Nicaragua. You have, on the one hand, the political alliance, the Democratic Convergence, which is analogous to the UNO that brought Chamorro into power in Nicaragua. And on the other hand, you have a kind of a contra force, which provides the muscle. That is not totally clear right now, but it seems to be functioning out of the Dominican Republic. There was a previous coup. Well, it wasn't a coup attempt, but it was an attack on July 28th of this year when commandos came across the border and attacked the military academy as well as a number of police stations, both on the Central Plateau and in Petionville. These attacks ended up with a number of policemen, I think it was five, died, and 14, 15 were wounded. Then they retreated to the Dominican Republic, where they received de facto political asylum. It seems this group, there is rumors that it is a group of police chiefs who were in fact trained by the U.S. In Ecuador. They're called the Ecuadorians. It's a group of 13 police chiefs who were discovered in a plot about a year ago and were expelled from Haiti to the Dominican Republic, where, once again, they got political asylum. So it seems the Dominican Republic is fulfilling the role of Honduras in the case of Haiti today, and they're continuing this slow boil of Haiti. The other similarity is that the Haitian government, in a way following a similar error that the Sandinistas made, keeps trying to appease Washington by offering concessions. They've included Duvalierists in their cabinet. They've made all sorts of...
And for those who haven't followed Haitian history, when you say Duvalierists...
Duvalierists, that is, these are followers of the father and son team that ruled Haiti for 30 years, François and Jean-Claude Duvalier from 1957 to 1986. These Duvalierists represent the old reactionary landowning elite, which has tried to come back. These are who the Tonton Macoutes, who are their muscle, rely on. And really the struggle we've seen is, in the past 15 years, is between this emerging democratic nationalist movement and this old order of Duvalierists aligned with Washington.
Can you compare in any way what's going on in Haiti today with the U.S. relationship with Afghanistan?
Well, I think that there's similarities in that it's the same group of people that brought about the Nicaragua scenario and what's happening in Haiti today and Afghanistan. These are Rumsfeld, these are Bush's cronies, Cheney, etc. Another irony is that they speak, for instance, of the repression of and oppression of women in Afghanistan. Haiti, during the coup, the FRAP, which was a CIA-created organization headed by Toto Constant, who presently has de facto political asylum here in New York City, this group was known to have raped women, carried out terrible assaults on the Haitian population, similar to what the Taliban may have carried out. And yet they are tolerated. They were termed, even by some State Department officials, as a terrorist organization. So it's an irony that, the U.S. says that it's fighting terrorism and yet harboring terrorists here in New York City. Furthermore, I think the what Aristide has called economic terrorism, that is through the embargo of aid to Haiti. Essentially, there's several hundred million dollars of aid which are being held up in the pipeline until a deal is struck with the convergence. And that deal is essentially a power-sharing relationship which Washington wants to see the convergence, its lackeys in control of the state, with Aristide there as a sort of portrait.
We're talking to Kim Ives, who is the editor of Haiti Progrès, about the situation in Haiti right now, the attempted coup that took place yesterday morning. Who is the head of the opposition alliance whose home got burned down?
Well, that's the The home that was burned down was that of Gerard Pierre Charles, who is actually a former Communist Party leader who sort of changed his coat, is a real turncoat, who became a champion of the neoliberal order that Washington prescribes for Haiti. He heads up a group called the OPL, which is the Organization of People in Struggle. Originally, it had been the political organization of the Lavalas, but it changed its name when they more or less broke with Aristide back in 95. OPL is one of the leaders. It's really a potpourri, this convergence, very much like the UNO. You find something of everything in it. Essentially, it's Washington-led. Washington financed the National Endowment for Democracy, has two wings, as we know, the National Democratic Institute and the International Republican Institute, called ERI, appropriately. And the ERI has funded not just money to support parties in Haiti, but to create parties. So they have 15 parties in this alliance. OPL is one of them. There was another group that is part of this alliance called ALA, whose headquarters was also burned down. CRESFED, which is a sort of a think tank connected to the OPL, was also burned down.
And yet, right now, Aristide was very much more compliant with the United States, much more so than when he came in as a fiery priest.
Exactly. And this is the irony. It's our opinion, and we've advised Aristide that on several occasions, that all his concessions, all his appeasement to Washington is in no way appeasing them. They won't be satisfied with anything other than his head on a platter. And even if he does want to become some sort of agent, some sort of intermediary between Washington and the people to try to give the neoliberal plan some sort of human face, which seems to be his end goal, which is, of course, a ridiculous notion because these types of dynamics have no concern for human suffering. The fact is he, in fact, is encouraging Washington, in our opinion, by showing this weakness, by not standing with the people firmly and acting on what he was originally, back in 1990, elected on. So by integrating all sorts of devaluerists into his ranks, he's created even more problems for himself because, in fact, there's tremendous infiltration in the police, in the government, in all levels of Haitian society.
Finally, do you think current Haiti is any lesson for Afghanistan? You had a U.S. occupation of Haiti. Aristide then returns. You have still one of the poorest countries on earth.
And even poorer than it was before. And that is, of course, the irony. Despite sinking $2 billion into Haiti since 1994, the country has gone downhill. Its food production has been undermined. Its industrial production, such as it was, has been undermined and essentially eliminated through dumping, through neoliberal trade, which has been reinforced, the removal of customs duties, etc. And therefore, what we're seeing is a real collapse of the infrastructure. And I think the same thing is possible.
And also an increase in the drug trade. And of
increase
course, Afghanistan was a major site of
No, I think
heroin
it's typical. It's the same thing that happened in Nicaragua, same thing that will happen in Haiti and probably will happen in Afghanistan.
For now, the coup has been put down?
I think the coup, you know, they didn't capture one. They didn't capture one of these assailants. They occupied the palace, and they all got away. This is the same thing that happened in July when an attack happened. So, and in fact, it was only one assailant, a Dominican, who was killed. And this is another sign. The Dominicans are working with them. So we think this is just one more probe, one more test. The real punch hasn't come. And we think the situation extremely fragile and Aristide is very vulnerable.
Well, Kim, I just want to thank you for being with us. If people want to read Haiti Progre online, where can they go?
They can go to www.haitiprogre.com. I'm just an editor there, not the editor.
And that's Progre with one progress with one S, Haiti Progre, on the line with us from Haiti with Jean-Gerard Debrie, the Secretary of State for Public Defense. You are listening to the War and Peace Report. When we come back, Another World is Possible, Conversations in a Time of Terror. Stay with us.
The towers lie in rubble at the center of a world trade. The latest lethal commerce, the signpost of the age. Funeral pyres still burning, people are afraid. That there's no place to hide has never been quite this plain. Some bold souls with convictions and reasons thought enough hijacked those jet airliners, turned them into bombs. The CIA trained their masters, they learned their lessons well. Came back from Afghanistan to blow us all to hell. The war has come home, you can smell it in the street. Oh, you can't wipe it away from your eyes. The war has come home, you can taste it on your teeth. Cries of vengeance rising on all sides. The counting houses emptied, the markets were closed down. So many bet this number would never come around. And now who will bet it won't happen again? Oh, that the war you're waging won't make things worse, my friend. And the flags are flying everywhere on high. People talk of the nation full of pride. The president's found his mission, the hawks are in full command. The media's cheerleading for the marching band.
Unholy War, L.A. Estrich, here on the War and Peace Report. L.A. Estrich, often on Radio Unnameable, which was a WBAI program until this past week, despite the legal settlements in the Pacifica struggle, because Bob Fass, who is the longtime host, one of the longest, one of the hosts of the longest duration at WBAI, some more than 30 years, because Bob Fass mentioned that there was a legal settlement, his program has been suspended at WBAI, so the struggle continues. Again, that was, though, L.A. Estrich often appears on Radio Unnameable, Unholy War. You are listening to the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Shortly after September 11th, as New York and the rest of the country struggled to come to terms with a changed world, activists began gathering together to try to develop and come up with talk about a response to the tragedy. In public spaces across the country, they grappled with the mixture of fear, sadness, anger, incomprehension, and loss. Many felt there was an urgent need to create an alternative vision of the events of that day. At the Independent Media Center in New York, video activists and writers threw themselves into putting out a newspaper and creating a video. The Independent Media Center is a network of collectively run media outlets established by independent and alternative media groups and activists to provide grassroots coverage of the World Trade Organization protests in Seattle last November. Through a decentralized and autonomous network, hundreds of media activists have since set up over 100 IMCs, or independent media centers, in cities like London, Canada, Mexico City, Prague, Belgium, France, Italy, Israel, and other places. In 2 weeks, the IMC video team, who've been shooting across the city, put out a video they called 911. It was the first film made after September 11th. Today, we'll watch and hear a few of the clips from that video, and we'll talk to a member of the Independent Media Center Video Collective who edited the film. We're also joined by a number of the editors of a new anthology that's out, Another World is Possible, Conversations in a Time of Terror. We go first to Rick Rowley of Big Noise Films and the IMC. Welcome to the War and Peace Report.
Thanks, Amy.
You followed a man in the subways. Can you tell us a little about him?
Well, I mean, in response to the sort of the crippling unanimity of the media, we all came to New York to convene a radical video response. And I was riding the A train down to the IMC for an early morning meeting. And a man came in and started singing in our subway car somewhere halfway through Central Park. And it was amazing. I've never felt a moment like it in New York. The entire car was instantly captivated and captured by this moment. And when he finished singing this gospel, they started talking about the war. So I followed him into the next subway car and asked him if I could film as he did it again.
America is at war with terrorists.
We're at war. We're having a series of
attacks today.
This is 21st century war.
America is at war with terrorists.
We're at war. We're absolutely at war. This is 21st century war.
I said I feel.
When the sun comes up today, that there's going to be an aftermath, and people are going to want to have a way to vent their pain, you know. Mm-hmm. And I thought this might do some healing, and apparently it's doing that. I've seen some amazing things happen here today. People crying, people arguing, people laughing, people singing, you know, and I haven't seen people do that in, as a body of people, you know, as a community of people do that in quite a long time.
We're under attack. Because if somebody attacked my house, I would defend myself. This is no time for diplomacy. I don't think that we should be talking a lot. I think that we should find out who did it. I think a lot of people know who did it, and we should just go out there and get them.
The people who did it should be punished. But I mean, that's not going to, you know, there might be 3,000, 4,000, I don't know. You know, average day, it's 50,000 people down there. Who knows how many people are under that building? You know, I mean, how do you punish somebody for that? You know, I mean, what can you do to them? You know? So what are we going to do? Go blow up a whole bunch of Afghani cities and Palestinian?
The sounds of 911. And that's the name of a film of the days just after September 11th attacks, put together by the Independent Media Center. Five of you put this film together, Rick Rowley?
Well, three collectives, five main people, but several other cameramen also involved. The main collectives involved were Big Noise Films, Paper Tiger Television, and the Independent Media Center, working collaboratively.
One of the people in that film said, you know, now we just have to attack. We've been under attack, and now we just have to protect ourselves. Jeremy Glick, what was your response after September 11th? You suffered a serious personal tragedy.
Yes. Unfortunately, my father, who was on the 64th floor of Tower 1, He was a supervisor in the Port Authority in the Treasury Department, and he stayed to let everyone out of the office. And out of around 100 people, they had 97 people in that floor, the 64th floor, made it. He being one of the three who did not. I was personally outraged at the sentiment expressed in the video, partially because I blame the Bush administration and that sector of the American ruling class for the death of my father and those other people in D.C. and in Pennsylvania and in New York. And I certainly don't want to see the agencies involved, the CIA, the FBI, American imperialism, further enfranchised to do harm and also to use my family's suffering as a way to justify further aggression against the Afghani people.
In the book, Another World is Possible, going throughout it are some emails between you and G. Kim, who is also here and one of the editors of the book. And G. Kim had received an email from someone else that said, Daily News reports Jeremy Glick as having been a passenger on one of the flights. Jeremy, as I understand it, is an activist also in the poetry scene, perhaps out of Jersey. I hear his name so much that when I heard that, I just threw it out there, thinking folks that know him might be able to drop him or his family a line to see if he was really on there, just trying to pass on info. So while your father did die, in fact, most people thought it was you who had died in one of the planes.
Yeah, I mean, it's not really an exaggeration. I'm not being hyperbolic to say that we got over 300 emails and over 100 calls from everyone, from friends of mine from Stress Magazine, people from the Rutgers Alumni Association, where I teach in the English department, people from the MOVE organization, friends, old partners, people I went to grade school with, because apparently the gentleman over Pennsylvania who heroically resisted his captors had my name, and he lived in the town adjacent to my folks' house. So unfortunately, when people called to see if I was all right, I had to explain to them about the fact that my dad was missing at that point, which was on the 11th.
And so how did you deal in those days, and how are you dealing now? That really is what this book that you're one of the editors of, Another World is Possible, Conversations in a Time of Terror, is about.
I mean, look, I'm an activist. I'm an educator. I teach at Rutgers. I teach New Brunswick High School, and I teach at NYU. And the forces that I've been consistently fighting against enabled the regime that did this. This is and probably will be the greatest thing to impact my family, to impact my mother, the immense amount of suffering. To know that those forces that are responsible, the George Bushes, the CIAs, the Ronald Reagans, are further enfranchised because of this makes it extremely difficult. And the only way that I could deal with this is to connect with a political movement with a response. G contacted me about this book project that was Another World is Possible, Conversations in Peace in a Time of Terror. And basically the idea was to get a collection of oppositional voices focused specifically around youth and youth of color working towards social change and working towards a situation where I don't have to feel and other families don't have to feel what we're going through.
What did you learn about your father since his death?
Since his death? Well, you know, it's crazy. I guess all activists from younger generations, we often have a little hostility towards our older mentors, meaning our parents, feeling that they were compromised. They compromised their early radicalism. And I think listening to my dad's eulogies, I realized how much his work sacrificed and enabled like the contributions that I've been able to make politically and through my writing, through my teaching, and through my activism. All the eulogies from my father at his memorial service, since we hadn't found a body, were all about his opposition to the Vietnam War, his participation in civil rights, the ERA amendment. And basically, I wasn't angry at my father anymore at the point of his death, because instead of thinking that he mellowed out or sold out, I thought that instead of working within a system, often the system works you, and specifically works your consciousness. And that same system paid him back by, you know, just violently tearing him away from his loved ones. So, I mean, what I learned is I think that there's a lot more in common between my father and I, and that became clear listening to his close friends and relatives, and my sister specifically eulogize him.
G. Kim, you first were wondering whether Jeremy was killed himself, and you too were working with other people in the wake of 9/11 and came up with the idea of Another World is Possible, putting together this book. Can you talk about it?
Yeah, well, in the immediate aftermath, everyone was just checking to see if their friends and close associates were okay, and I got this email through the activist community, and I've known Jeremy for a number of years. But separately, there was a other group of activists, community activists, media activists, some from the foundation world, who just got together and said, we have to figure out a way to promote a conversation that allows, you know, dissenting voices, that allows us to explore what the real causes are of what just happened. So we sat down and we decided to put together an anthology. And what we needed to do was recruit people from diverse movements to really create a broad anthology that includes the globalization movement, the social justice movement, the racial justice movement. And so I went out and I had been speaking to Jeremy a lot about this, about the whole situation. And Jeremy's what Jeremy was dealing with was one of the things that made it really real for me, because there was a sense of detachment when everything I was getting was through the media, and I was immediately kind of turned off. And so we went out and recruited five other editors to help put the content together and edit it and filter through it. And in the space of about 6 to 8 weeks, we finished the book and design and production and content. And then the whole thing took about 3 months from start to end.
We have to break four stations to identify themselves. We're talking about Another World. Another World is Possible, Conversations in a Time of Terror. You're listening to the War and Peace Report. Back in a minute.
There was fire and blood in the hallways, explosions and shattering glass. There was crying and screaming. Some jumped from the flames as the building went down with a crash. Now thousands are dead in the ruins. We've been shaken right down to the core. So many are calling for vengeance as the country gets ready for war. Is it evil that makes men such killers? Some race or religion we hate? Is it the rich and the poor locked in a war? Is it fear? Is it rage? Is it fate? It's justice we need, not more killing. Nobody's hands are clean. There'll be no peace for the living till we know what the dead really mean. 'Cause an eye for an eye isn't Jesus. It's not Buddha, Muhammad, or God.
Slaughter of Innocents, Moss Henry, a listener who sent in his music to the War and Peace Report. And you can do that, too, by sending email to mail@democracynow.org and letting us know what you'd like to share with us. I'm Amy Goodman as we talk about Another World is Possible, Conversations in a Time of Terror, a book that has been put together by activists in response to 9/11, along with a film, a project of the Independent Media Center, the IMC movement in this country, that's called 9/11. Rick Rowley, can you introduce this next segment?
This next segment, this film as a collaboration is composed of segments, 5-minute segments, each edited by a different collective, which gives it, each segment has a different texture and a different focus. So this is a segment cut by the IMCs that is about U.S. foreign policy and tries to contextualize this violence inside of a history of violence overseas.
And it includes segments from teach-ins that have been held since 9/11. Let's roll it.
It's difficult to know how to speak about the events of Tuesday of last week. Any attempt at explanation risks sounding to others like a justification.
This is an act of mass murder. It's an act of terrorism and has to be condemned.
Understanding, rather than the bombers now on their way to Afghanistan, is the only possible means to making sure that we don't have to endure an event like that again.
It comes from somewhere. It comes from some experience with American power, in some sense, political power, economic power, cultural power, right? We all educated ourselves about Vietnam. We educated ourselves about Central America. We learned about a lot of places that most Americans had never heard of before and figured out who is what and what the political and social forces were. We can do the same thing about the Middle East. It's not unknowable.
Iran, 1953, the CIA backed a violent coup to protect U.S. oil interests. Over the next 26 years, 70,000
Iranians are in jail. Since the 1950s, the United States has helped keep unpopular and corrupt regimes in power in most of the Middle East, and in some cases helped overthrow or destabilize the relatively popular ones. The Mossadegh regime in Iran, in government in Iran in 1953, is, of course, one of the well-known ones.
Also, our policy vis-a-vis Palestine and Israel is problematic to many Muslims.
People can see on their television sets Palestinians being shot and killed every day by, again, an Israel that's armed and financed and backed diplomatically only by the United States.
Both the steady reorganization of wealth and power and the repression that keeps it in place are supported by the United States. Its economic advisors play a day-to-day role in those corrupt government ministries. The United States Army uses military bases in the country, and it supplies the military and the policing equipment that keeps the regime in power. In 1990, Iraq invaded Kuwait, as you know. America responded with a war that may have killed 200,000 Iraqi conscripts and with a sanctions regime that is said to have led to the deaths of 1 million Iraqis, half of them children.
Well, supporting a regime in Saudi Arabia, which admittedly does send a lot of relatively cheap oil to the United States and to its allies, and this yields great profits for American corporations, but brutally represses its own people.
The presence of U.S. troops in Saudi Arabia and in the Gulf is also very problematic because many Muslims regard the oil reserves of that part of the world to be to belong to all of the Muslims, and they don't like seeing them under the control of a foreign power, which they obviously are.
The Taliban during the Cold War was actually a creation of the United States and Pakistan.
The Soviet Union had invaded Afghanistan, and Washington saw an opportunity to make its life difficult. With the help of the Saudi and the Pakistan governments, the CIA undertook the biggest secret American war in history. For the people of Afghanistan, more years of horror, of civil war, and then the puritanical and horribly repressive order of the Taliban.
It's been one disastrous policy after another, and all within the same framework. And it's led us to this terrible moment when finally those chickens have come home to roost. Anyone who commits this kind of attack, who commits mass murder against civilians, is warped. But they're not stupid, and they are very much hoping that George Bush and his administration walk right into the trap they've laid.
This would not likely hurt the Islamic groups, who are small, dispersed, and anyhow do not fear death. But it would force the regimes of the Middle East to ally themselves and support this alien violence.
I think that if we militarily defeat them, which I'm sure we can, I mean, for that matter, we could turn the whole of Afghanistan to a sheet of glass with a nuclear weapon, but that will not solve the problem, because there are many, many more people like them who will be willing to commit the kinds of crimes we saw last week.
There will be more days like September 11th in this country, and a lot more days like September 11th, as there have been many days like September 11th in many countries around the world. And I don't think we want to live like that, and I know no one else on the planet wants to live like that. And this is a turning point, because we're headed down a very dangerous road of confrontation, of states falling apart, of bloody war, and not just over there, but here as well, in ways that none of us want to think about. If we don't find some way out of this.
The sounds of 911. It's a new film that has been put together by the Independent Media Center movement in this country, Paper Tiger and Big Noise Films. We're joined on the phone now from Berkeley by Shafi Moil, who was not in the United States on September 11th. Where were you, Shafi?
I was in Durban, South Africa.
Why?
I had just attended the United Nations World Conference Against Racism, and the conference had just ended a week earlier, and I was still visiting friends there.
And where were you when you heard about what took place?
I was heading to a park with a friend, and it started raining. So we jumped into the first cafe that we could find, and, you know, it was just people relaxing and talking. And then the radio was on, and I thought I heard an American accent speaking kind of in a panicked voice about bombs, explosion, things falling apart. And I asked the waiter if he could turn on the TV, and he flipped it to the news just in time to see the second plane hit the second tower, and the cafe just kind of fell silent. And everyone, it was like that for like 10 minutes, just silence, everyone staring at the TV.
And then how did they respond to you as an American?
At first, everyone was really curious to know where we were from, if we were from New York, if we knew anyone there, if they kept offering condolences. And, you know, my friend and I were just shocked, like we couldn't believe that this had happened. And we were both Middle Easterners, so immediately we both, the first thing that popped into our head was, we hope that they're not going to start blaming people that look like us. We hope that it wasn't people that look like us who were responsible. And we started speaking in Farsi. I mean, that's our native language. And then as soon as it was evident that we were not American-Americans, which is what they were thinking, you know, in terms of, like, we were not white Americans and we were not, like, hadn't been living in America for centuries or whatever, then it became a different sort of atmosphere in the cafe among the white South Africans and us. And it became one of actually hostility, and comments were made that made us feel like we weren't welcome there and weren't really safe there, so we left.
And now you've come back and are working with the Students for Justice in Palestine?
At UC Berkeley, yeah, that's right.
We're also joined in the studio by Becca Kanamopoulos, environmental and anti-globalization activist. You are a part of this anthology, Another World is Possible. Your responses after 9/11 and what you felt it was important to convey in this book.
I was pretty lost after 9/11. I didn't know how the work that I'd been doing for the past couple of years would translate after an attack that happened in the fashion that it did. And I felt pretty disconnected from my activist community. I wasn't ready to jump into rhetoric and analysis. I felt like a lot of the meetings that the left hosted were sort of sectarian and process heavy. And that a lot of the pro-peace, anti-war marches were creating these antagonistic and adversarial dynamics between bystanders and passersby and folks advocating for a positive and better future. So I had to take a little time out. And it wasn't until Billy Upski and G approached me with a proposal to be involved in this book that I felt like I had a place to plug in. And I was really, really inspired about the strategy behind using this book as an organizing tool. We're making the book available for free to a number of community organizations and youth organizations so that they can use this as a fundraising mechanism and as a tool to spread the word and spark dialogue. And we're embarking upon a 36-city tour in the new year so that we can take this message and the analysis and the poetry and the art and the spirit that the book conveys out to folks around the country and talk about next steps. How do we create another world or other worlds from here?
So you're packaging the book and the video 9/11 together. G. That's Kim, right. I was wondering if you could read this quote that is highlighted in the book, Another World is Possible. And it's a quote from a Nazi in World War II.
From Hitler's number two man, Hermann Goering. Why, of course, people don't want war. Why should some poor slob on a farm want to risk his life in a war when the best he can get out of it is to come back to his farm in one piece? Naturally, the common people don't want war, neither in Russia nor in England, nor for that matter in Germany. That is understood. But after all, it is the leaders of the country who determine the policy, and it is always a simple matter to drag the people along. Whether it is a democracy or a fascist dictatorship or a parliament or a communist dictatorship. Voice or no voice, the people can always be brought to the bidding of the leaders. That is easy. All you have to do is tell them that they are being attacked and denounce the peacemakers for lack of patriotism and exposing the country to danger. It works the same in any country. Prophetic.
That Hermann Goering from World War II about how to galvanize people for war. Well, you've certainly done something different in this book, Another World is Possible, Conversations in a Time of Terror, and I want to thank you all for being with us, the editors of this book, G. Kim and Jeremy Glick, Shafi Moil on the telephone, Becca Economopoulos, and Rick Rowley with Big Noise Films and the film 9/11. Another World is Possible. If people want to get in touch with you, where can they call or go on the web?
The website is anotherworldispossible.net. And our distributor is newmouthfromthedirtysouth.com. And if you have a local bookstore, ask them to get the book, and they can order from our distributor.
Well, thank you. And the film?
And the film is available from the Independent Media Center, nyc.indiemedia.org, and Big Noise Films, bignoisefilms.com.
And you can go to our website for all that contact information at democracynow.org. Jackie Suhin is our webmaster and also part of Big Noise Films. That does it for the program, Democracy Now! In Exile, produced by Chris Abrams, Brad Simpson, Miranda Kennedy, with help from Lizzie Ratner. Errol Maitland is our technical director in exile over at WBIX.org. Anthony Sloan is our engineer and music maestro. We're broadcasting in exile from the embattled studios of WBAI, from the studios of the Band and the Fire, the studios of our listeners. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.